This is tape 3 of Goblin Hood Satyricon, copyright 1995 by James Beatty, read by Goblin Hood. This tape begins somewhere in the... Well, somewhere I think in the middle of the seemingly endless labyrinth of chapter 20, which is about St. Cloud. So we're getting into that part. So anyway, on with the show. And so, with the stakes at such improbable heights, and with himself armed only with grit, spunk, and pluck, and with the rather corny beliefs that honesty is the best policy and that the truth will out regardless, St. Cloud courageously undertook the greatest endeavor of his career, eventually unleashing upon an unwary world his most ambitious creation of all time, the twofold enigma which he soon took to calling Smiley. As noted, all this started in the 1950s, specifically in 1951, when St. Cloud was born. Moreover, the first quarter or so of St. Cloud's story took place in the rural Midwest, a backwards sort of environment that tended to make the 50s alone seem like the age of enlightenment. At such a time, and in such a place, there was seldom much of anything going on. Most of St. Cloud's initial cultural orientation was presided over by the earliest, brazenly bashful overtures of television, and by the omnipresent sound of his mother's battery-operated radio. It was via his mother's radio that young St. Cloud could listen to folksy, self-important windbags like Paul Harvey hold forth and wise off on the subject of how much better they knew about everything than anybody else did. Young St. Cloud took the chilling message to heart. But there was also plenty of music, not only the primordial manifestations of rock and roll, but also the kind of romantic, sentimental slop that people like St. Cloud's mother used to listen to back then. And at some point, a popular hit tune captured the embryonic artist's fancy. The song was called Smile and was, perhaps, sung by Nat King Cole or by someone who sounded like him. But the song was supposedly written by one of the greatest comedians of all time and a genius of silent film, Charlie Chaplin. So anyway, St. Cloud had dimly heard. Myself, I wouldn't know. I also wouldn't know whether Chaplin is supposed to have written the song before or after he got kicked out of the USA during the McCarthy witch hunt of the 50s. The point is, whoever wrote it, that it was an okay little song and that it managed, with its wistful emotionalism, to snap the garters of St. Cloud's heartstrings or whatever. But he subconsciously intuited a deeper message than the obvious from what the song was saying, which was that you should smile even if your heart was breaking, even if they're kicking your head in or whatever, etc., etc., etc. St. Cloud had always felt himself at bay, stranded in an inimical environment, surrounded by his instinctively feared and fanatically hostile natural enemies, everyone on Earth. His natural instinct was to run from danger, especially in the face of such overwhelming odds. Interestingly, this was confirmed years later by the social or psychiatric worker who got St. Cloud briefly committed to a mental hospital. "You're a runner, St. Cloud," she pronounced mercilessly, mostly referring to his petty drug addictions. "You run away from life. You don't face anything the way you should." She then proceeded to give St. Cloud yet another mammoth bugbear to scamper frantically away from, the entire field of organized psychiatry. Ultimately, though, one can't run away from a menace the size of Earth's total population, and so St. Cloud fell back on subterfuge and synthetic politesse as his main tools for getting by. And though there was precious little in his miserable world to smile about, he adopted that rictus as protective coloration and resolved to blandly smile his way from one humiliating debacle to the next. For some reason, his greatest fear was the discovery by other people of just how deeply their behavior could hurt him. Actually, a pretty reasonable fear, come to think of it. And so, being no born smiler, St. Cloud began to carefully construct an artificial persona capable of doing that for him, capable of providing him with shelter, of being fully hidden within. And yet, St. Cloud himself was just a mask of amiability, disguising the grim reality of the dinosaur. I don't know at what point Smiley took over public management of the St. Cloud operations, nor whether the two aspects of Smiley evolved simultaneously or what. I only know that it was Smiley whom I first met. A likable enough young fellow, though just a bit of a sap. Smiley was the very eidolon of insipid bonhomie, but he probably took special pains to charm me with an eye to enlisting my clerical services. I also don't know just how to explain the effect Smiley had on people. Indeed, if not for my association with goblinhood, I probably couldn't have understood Smiley at all. His face was a mask, and a boringly innocuous vizard it was. I later found out that St. Cloud had appropriated the features during the malaise of the Vietnam War when the image first appeared. Smiley's face, you see, was modeled after the empty "have a nice day" smirk of the omnipresent happy face sigil. With this badge of nominally harmless mediocrity, Smiley managed to ward off all potential conflict, or most of it. It wasn't that people actually liked Smiley or anything, it was just that he mostly didn't seem worth the trouble of actively disliking. I guess that most people, if they thought about the mask at all, simply assumed that Smiley was imaginatively covering up some horrible disfigurement. I know that I thought that for a while. And, very ironically, since goblinhood sometimes gives people the same impression. Little could any of us have known, however, that the deformity was mainly located within Smiley's soul. Occasionally, of course, even Smiley would inadvertently get someone's goat, and trouble could indeed then ensue. The first time I saw Smiley meet trouble of such ilk, I was actually flabbergasted. I'd always thought of him as an inoffensive chump and left it at that. But as the conversation heated up, and as his communicant began taking personal umbrage at some facet of Smiley's outward presentation, a bizarre change came over the smirking bastard. Smiley suddenly ripped off his mask to reveal beneath it another mask, wearing a different kind of smile, a lurid grin, in fact. This face was apparently derived from the fantastic makeup worn by Conrad Veidt in the silent film version of Victor Hugo's The Man Who Laughs. Naturally, it also resembled the protagonist in the descendant of that film, William Castle's adaptation of a Ray Russell story, Mr. Sardonicus, and the cheesy makeup worn by Guy Rolfe. And indeed, Smiley's second face truly seemed a parody of the rhesus sardonicus, reportedly associated in medical circles with tetanus or lockjaw or something. The effect of this image, which Smiley called Smiley 2, or more commonly lickjaw, was actually pretty shocking. But more shocking still was the way in which his outward personality immediately began to subtly reflect his now ghastly visage. His former agreeable and non-committal bland optimism was now usurped by an increasingly vicious use of sarcasm and cruel invective, and his world view now seemed to personify jaded and disdainful cynicism and contempt. I don't remember how that particular argument shook out, but I know it was a while before I got a glimpse of what lurked beneath the exterior of Smiley 2. And beneath that? In passing, it might seem passing odd that such an important free thinker and freewheeling exponent of truth as St. Cloud could bring himself to sit around skulking behind a couple of asinine masks. No courageous act, this, what? Is what you're probably thinking. And maybe you'd be right if Smiley hadn't been responsible for facilitating the only chance of free expression that St. Cloud had any kind of access to. Smiley enabled St. Cloud to at least express some things, as opposed to running away into a total state of social withdrawal. And besides, as St. Cloud might have said while peremptorily snarfing down another whopping big handful of trees and all, Smiley is the truth as far as he goes. He reflects my deeply buried yearning to get away, to get along with people and to fit in. This said wistfully through thick clouds of recreational smoke. A likely saga about that yearning bit, in my opinion, or partial opinion. I just couldn't associate lick jaw with yearning. Anyway, it said, if said yearning was that deeply buried, it would have no doubt been long since eaten by the omnivorous dinosaur, the only part of St. Cloud which had been crafted by any nature save his own. On the other hand, I could relate easily to the notion of Smiley as a desperate vehicle by which St. Cloud could aspire to any expression at all. It happens that I sort of know the feeling well from having been through much the same kind of thing with goblinhood. Though nowhere near as hag-ridden as St. Cloud, I too personally tend toward a reserve that's punctured easily by various kinds of embarrassment and even by morbid shame. So goblinhood's surprisingly deceptive aspect of impenetrability often helps me face life calmly, despite my inhibitions. In return, though, he gets to use my body for his performance art, and goblinhood, despite my inhibitions, will do things on stage that I could never even dream of without blushing. In fact, he even wanted to, but no, forget it. And so anyway, there I was, like a bad copy of Boswell, obsequiously ingratiating myself with St. Cloud's unlikely Sam Johnson by hanging out with Smiley and typing up the egregious Labyrinth of Venereal Vestals. And for quite a while, I thought. And for quite a while, I thought it was just me, Goblinhood, Smiley, Lich, Lickjaw, the Renegade Club, and whoever the hell St. Cloud really was. But I eventually realized, to my dumbfoundment, that St. Cloud himself was but a flimsy homemade facade fronting for a creature they all furtively referred to as the dinosaur. And when I talk about the unbreakable grip of St. Cloud's repressions and inhibitions, I'm talking, of course, about the dinosaur. And when I talk about St. Cloud's secret, almost subcellular thraldom to his conception of the world as enemy, I'm referring, of course, to the dinosaur. And when I mention Smiley's chameleon-like way of adapting to his surroundings, it goes without saying that this survival trait most directly harks back to the dinosaur. And when the subject of Lickjaw even comes up, when his bloodthirsty sense of satire is remarked upon, or his voracious appetite for the emotional discomfiture of others is noted, I must admit that these tastes are mere refinements of a pure lust to rend and tear and to survive at all costs inherent to the primitive, lumbering dinosaur relentlessly dragging its spiked tail or whatever through the ashes and ruins of the latter half of the 20th century, forever looking for something to eat and willing to eat almost anything that got in its way. Brainlessly seeking, via instinct alone, to avoid its many enemies and thus to prolong its totally meaningless excuse for a life. And I believe that the microcephalic awareness of the dinosaur would have eventually allowed extinction to overtake the beast had not that rudimentary form of intelligence been just smart enough to create a humanoid front capable of true sentience of a sort, and known to the world at large as the artist Raymond St. Cloud. And behold, it came to pass that St. Cloud begat Smiley in the fullness of time, and that Smiley, I don't know, may have pretended that he begat Smiley too or something, I don't know. It gets sort of complicated, and I guess it's not that important. And I guess the big question might seem to be, which of those entities was really and truly the real human being or reasonable facsimile thereof under discussion here, but the answer strikes me and goblinhood as self-evident, that they all were, though St. Cloud often described the three outer layers as being the most sincerely real, in that they were the deliberate creations of rational, sick thought. The dinosaur, he maintained, was a fairly typical product of its environment, having been shaped largely by hazard and by random chance. And it was the dinosaur, I guess, whose mindless cravings had led the jolly crew into drug addiction. That certainly doesn't sound like something which our eminent author and celebrated bon vivant, St. Cloud, would stoop to, nor did Smiley's affable indifference to everything seemingly point to a seething urge toward drug-crazed abandon. As for Lick Jaw, he didn't need drugs or have time for them. He was too busy being high on life, a term he sardonically commandeered from Smiley, and also being high on the pleasure of needling his adversaries in so unpleasantly erudite a fashion that they eventually gave up in disgust and with a great show of repugnance went away and left him alone. No, it was the dinosaur, I guess, that was caught taking drugs and, in specific, slobbering red-handed all over something which it thought of as Substance D. Substance D, of course, is actually the mythical drug so pervasively on hand in Philip K. Dick's eminently dystopian novel, A Scanner Darkly. Dick, of course, is the near-legendary author of the science fiction drug classic, The Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch, and of Ubik, in which the characters could routinely acquire potent amphetamines out of handy and omnipresent vending machines. Phil Dick's Substance D, of course, eventually rotted the brains of its devotees or something, whereas neither St. Cloud nor Smiley had ever given much thought to what Substance Treasonal might actually have been doing for a year and a half to the dinosaur's minuscule brain or to its health in general beyond those celebrated old distressing side effects, that is. And of course a dinosaur, near brainlessly, never did seem to give much of a shit. Ironically, its blunt instinct for survival had now deserted without leave under combat conditions. The dinosaur's instinctive urge to survive had transferred itself miraculously, perhaps as if magnetically, to the addiction itself, a near tangible force which now meant to survive at any cost for its own sake, but which was now doomed from the start, condemned in the death lottery by recent political history, destined to become just an unsung, or not very sung, casualty of that masterpiece of folly and self-deception, the Great Drug War, America's favorite pastime whenever America chanced not to be taking drugs. And what the hell was St. Cloud doing while the dinosaur was off dicking around with dope, sapping its precious bodily health and vigor and running the serious risk of slightly inconveniencing its remote and aloof alternate personae when the treasonal ran out? What else would St. Cloud had been doing, but writing up his findings, polishing up the great work, dedicating his life to truth in defiance of his myriad inhibitions, let alone those of the world, and exploring bold new frontiers of expression, as he liked to believe, via labyrinth of venereal vestals. St. Cloud was much given to seeing himself in the role of scientific pioneer, like a Freud or a Jung or a Desaad, but Desaad was the only one he could really reasonably aspire to emulate. He wanted to be like Prometheus, the light bringer, but half the time he couldn't even get a light when he asked some average Joe on the street, "Hey buddy, you got a light?" But he could still get the bird and a bucket of guts ripped out of him. St. Cloud was pleased to imagine himself doing something poetic with particle accelerators like Dr. Frankenstein and Harlan Ellison's Hugo-winning story, Adrift Just Off the Islets of Langerhans, etc. But Raymond was actually a lot more like that poor jerk, largely mute and inglorious, from Kurt Vonnegut Jr.'s story, The Big Space Fuck, whose cum wasn't worth shooting freeze-dried into space because all he did was make birdhouses. But it is greatly to his credit that, in spite of his interests and his megalomania, the one thing which Raymond St. Cloud never did wish to become, for as long as he was in his right mind, was like that other Dr. Raymond in Arthur Machen's classic tale, The Great God Pan, who had more or less lobotomized his own adopted daughter while trying to prove some crackpot theory about something or other. St. Cloud, to the contrary, though no expert on the subject of harmlessness, took great pains to be as harmless as possible in his lunacy, right up to the end. At worst, he sometimes put in the odd moment here and there, raving and gibbering at people, occasionally even undertaking to write such frenzied twaddle down. But the last thing he wanted to do was to hurt anyone. It's just too bad that... But no, I mustn't get ahead of my story. Machen's story, by the way, was clearly the inspiration to some extent for Lovecraft's great masterpiece, The Dunwich Horror, in which an unbelievably horrible monster terrorizes everyone except a weazened, but unpleasantly erudite, librarian who's armed with little more than sheer optimism and pluck, of course. In any case, it was that penchant for being as harmless as possible, almost an involuntarily reflex after a while, which St. Cloud, though no expert, of course, had magnified to near fetish proportions, which comprised the artist's most endearing attribute. And the same could be languidly said about Smiley in a desultory kind of way. And Smiley, too, well, I guess he would have wanted you to define harmlessness and would have wanted it so obnoxiously as to have irritated you into just going away and leaving him alone. But it's too bad that St. Cloud couldn't have extended that same meticulous solicitude to himself or to his buddy Smiley, or at least to the moronic dinosaur whose imbecilic whims and whams had gotten them all hooked on treason all. which in turn had corrupted St. Cloud into committing the ultimate treason of forsaking his own misgivings and actually trying to write an illustrated novel. Or maybe he was simply fleeing all the pressures and pitfalls into the safety and obscurity of a nigh-dead art form. And then there were those distressing side effects: nausea, dizziness, nervous collapse. So far, the symptoms emblematic of a treasonal Jones had been pretty consistent, though increasingly ominous. And the point, of course, was rapidly becoming moot, had done so already, in fact, and was just waiting around for St. Cloud, for the dinosaur, to catch up with reality. But St. Cloud, as was oft his wont, was dawdling and dilly-dallying way behind, like a straggler off in the past, back there somewhere, no doubt rejoicing in daydreams of a misremembered golden age of treasonal, when substance D was practically falling from the sky and damn near oozing and flopping right out of people's asses. A season of halcyon splendor, made mostly out of nostalgic wishful thinking, during which the very streets themselves had proverbially seemed to be paved with treasonal. Clearly, St. Cloud didn't want to face the music about reality, or about anything. Didn't want to deal with the coming ordeal. Was unwilling to give up the least feature of his golden arm. Was unwilling to give up even those distressing side effects which usually approximated a familiar pattern, more or less as follows. 1. After ingesting his first big hit of the days, St. Cloud would enjoy a mild, speedy rush, similar to Dexedrine, and a small amount of euphoria, though these features had, of late, drastically atrophied. 2. Within 10 hours or so of initial commencement, St. Cloud would be obliged to choke down some food so that he could take another voluntary overdose on a full stomach. These skyrocketing dosages would now have to happen every 5 hours or so, and had always to be accompanied by an unwilling meal. The problem, or one of them, was that treasonal abuse made the mere idea of eating seem repulsive, nauseating even. This conflict eventually reached epic proportions after some 1.5 years and was often accompanied by violent and involuntary regurgitation, seemingly at random, and sometimes by an appalling sense of queasy vertigo. Is that le mot juste? No, it was actually more like a horrible, weightless feeling, an empty, hollow sensation of substance in absentia, the feeling of a fragile toy balloon bogged down with a useless cargo of vaporized filth and corruption. 3. All of these effects would swell and intensify as the session progressed, and would be joined suavely by a frenzied scraping of the nerves and a palsied spasm of the limbs, ever gaining in force until the binge was over, usually about 3 days after liftoff, at which point the artist either finally went to bed or fell asleep in a chair. This little scenario was played out as often as 7 times a month and had become, by the end, the normal routine for St. Cloud, who had also begun routinely glimpsing peripheral horrors and monstrosities from the weary corners of his crisp eyes, usually around the end of the second day. Of course, many of these phenomena can be attendant upon the bare fact of sleep deprivation itself, as I've had occasion to learn the hard way. And of course, it was chiefly the sleep deprivation itself, the idea of gradually dispensing with sleep, which primarily attracted St. Cloud, causing him to turn a blind eye toward the downside of the dinosaur's idiotic habit. And of course, St. Cloud had what he thought were good reasons for this, and perhaps he wasn't far wrong. Sleep had always been St. Cloud's most contentious adversary. Even as a small child, St. Cloud had been forced to recognize the need for sleep as his mortal foe. Of course, it must have been the dinosaur that suffered from chronic nocturnal enuresis. But wait, no, not this time. The dinosaur says no. The dinosaur isn't having any this go-round. The dinosaur may be simply indulging in some variety of obscure paleoencephalic snit here, but even so, no. Even a dinosaur can get fed up when certain subjects arise, and this turns out to be one of them. And the dinosaur doesn't want to play anymore, doesn't want to take the rap for this one, and no wonder. Even a reptile can get a bellyful, and this is where the line gets drawn. And so the dinosaur refuses to accept responsibility for this situation, as in,
"Gee willikers, Uncle Popeye, we don't want no spinach nor any responsibility. We want hamburgers instead. Ha-ka-ka-ka-ka."
Well now, a certain breach of diplomacy, let alone responsibility, to be sure. But then what did one expect? That's what chronic nocturnal enuresis is like, commonly known as bedwetting. And not even Smiley wanted to eat this one, whereas Lickjaw would have waxed too sardonic for words at the mere mention of it. And so it fell to St. Cloud. But St. Cloud didn't want to put up with it either, only he didn't have any choice, until he learned to deny it, until he learned to occlude it, until his mind decided that it was better to live in darkness than to face the pitiless, merciless light. Somehow St. Cloud's malady was never fully explained or even partially accounted for, though it didn't seem from certain indications to be a physiological problem. It just so happened, I guess, but it happened virtually every night of his life until he was 25 years old. Then it just stopped. He once claimed that he made the problem go away through prayer, but one wonders just what he'd spent the previous quarter of a century doing, besides pissing in bed, that is. But in all fairness, St. Cloud had never prayed about it before for fear that nothing would happen, thus demolishing what little religious faith he was able to have in the first place. But I guess that at age 25, he was just that desperate, you know? Meanwhile, it seems less likely that prayer alone would have stopped a purely physical infirmity. But I guess you never know, you know? In any case, St. Cloud stopped suffering from this, through prayer or otherwise, when he was 25, but by that time it was way too late, but much better late than never, knock wood, you know. Unfortunately, St. Cloud had spent the previous 25 years in a constant state of denial, learning to occlude reality on a more or less selective basis, learning above all not to let himself think about it. He'd had to spend those long years, perforce, doing things every day that he hated with every single fiber of his being. Things like exchanging freshly pissed on sheets for pissy sheets that had at least dried. Things like having to wash his entire wardrobe every single time he got the chance. Things like wallowing in cologne so that at least he wouldn't smell like urine. Things like wondering why him. Things like turning red and groping for words every time some relative went off and gave him hell about it, as if it was his fault. Things like believing that it was his fault, to the extent that he could acknowledge or face that it was happening at all. A capacity which eventually started approaching zero. Things like actually wondering, the poor bastard, if very many people had caught on. Things like carefully praying for anything under the sun except the thing he wanted most. Things like never being able to talk about it, not even among other bedwetters. Things like wanting to kill people who treated it as a joke or a personality defect. Things like searching high and low for the mystery enuretic, an agent which causes enuresis. He thought he'd found it in the mirror, alas. Guess those relatives were right after all. Things like secretly yearning deep down inside to get along better with everybody and above all, to fit in, to be just like everybody else. Wow, I guess that bit about Smiley was right after all. Things like learning to live outside all the time for the rest of his fucking life. Things like almost wishing that he were a dwarf instead. Things like wishing that he could blame it all on the dinosaur. But the dinosaur wasn't even around this time. Things like hating almost everyone's guts for being so normal, for making him be so different. Things like pretending to rejoice that he was different from the rest of the herd and then pretending to believe that he really felt that way while schooling himself to make the most possible virtue out of necessity, to make the most majestic mountains of madness out of the smelliest, ugliest, wartiest, pissiest, and most utterly feculent little molehills that he could find on the map anywhere around. And God help those poor hapless moles now. All these and other, even stranger things, St. Cloud learned to do regularly, mindlessly, mechanically, and downright robotically. Such things amounted to his most basic programming. And how he hated them. And how he hated everything. And how he survived the perennial trauma of it all. And how that would make a pretty good story all by itself. And how. Or at least another pukey self-help text, anyhow. Perhaps the weirdest thing St. Cloud ever tried to pull off regarding this ongoing crisis was the Great Rubber Experiment. The Great Rubber Experiment was yet another act of desperation, performed at a time when the situation had grown, as it periodically grew, virtually intolerable. This was in high school, and it might have been during his senior year, which would mean that St. Cloud had been carrying this burden around stoically, but oh so bitterly, without the slightest hope of help or counsel, and dealing with it literally every day for something like 17 hellish years. But now everything would finally be okay now, he hoped. Now it was finally all over now, he almost prayed. Now he believed that he might just have brainstormed up a miracle cure, or the next best thing anyway, a chance to at least seem normal, even if he could never actually be normal. As Kurt Vonnegut Jr. might have put it while writing The Sirens of Titan, in a universe that was schemed in mercy, this clever little desperate scheme would have been allowed to work. And yet, knock wood, I understand that years later, or eons later for that matter, St. Cloud and all his buddies might actually have been able to laugh about this, with all due respect, in paradise. That is, if he'd swallowed the right crock of holy shit. Yes, and there we'd all be. Yes, me too, as witness, sitting around, no doubt, at the Paradise branch of the Renegade Club, in the sitting room, no doubt, probably merrily twinkling our eyes at each other through the twinkling of mellow old brandy in mellow old brandy snifters or something. And the whole sick crew would be there, the original Renegade Club, Maya included, and the dinosaur, I guess, probably dimly wondering when dinner was to be served, and even such characters as Smiley and Goblin Hood, fast friends, of course, if just a bit of a couple of saps, but somehow, miraculously, existing on their own now. Free at last. Yes, and even Smiley too would be there, lurking in some remote corner, no doubt, perhaps gazing sardonically out of a window or something, proudly and very sardonically aloof from the hilarious rest of the good old gang, probably twinkling his eyes sardonically through a mug of sardonic beer at the sardonic vista of the great outside, outside the great window, or whatever, and most likely wishing, oh so bitterly, that people would stop calling him Lickjaw. And legend states that some 6,000 loyal followers of Sardonicus were executed by victorious Roman troops following the abortive Smart-Aleck uprising of circa 60 BC, but unlike the captured 6,000 escaped slaves, gladiators, and freedom fighters who had fought and lost with Spartacus, the Sardonicus mob weren't crucified along the Appian Way between Rome and Capua. The Romans still remembered the smell from last time. Instead, the doomed Weisenheimers were made to mercilessly satirize each other and themselves, and were then forced to laugh themselves to death along the Appian Way by order of one Dorcas Crassass, eminent Roman general, celebrated bon vivant, and the richest man in Rome at that time. For what it's worth, his severed fat head was said to have been served years later at a Parthian wedding feast with a mechanical laughing box in its mouth instead of an apple. But the snide martyrs died a glorious, hilarious death amid violent spasms of parody, buried right up to their smart asses in sheer fol-de-rol and fiddle-dee-dee, chortling and guffawing as if there was no tomorrow, which there wasn't. Some fun, eh? But anyway, there we all would be, hanging out at the Heavenly Renegade Club like an I-Corps plenary council or something. And of course, the rollicking good times, high-spirited hijinks, and boisterous, good-natured fun would presently be started rolling by that madcap messiah, Jesus, anything for a laugh, Christ, or that carpentry-crazed cut-up of Calvary, as we liked to think about calling him. "What ho there, St. Cloud, me laddie," he would belch boisterously and good-naturedly with a side order of high-spirited hijinks. "Do you recall by any chance that jolly time so long ago when I got to watch you piss in your bed for 25 big ones because you were too damn dumb or too faithless to pray for help about it? Ha ga 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 ga. What a laugh riot, eh, what? What a sad-assed excuse for a savior, eh, what, Mr. Jolly Joker?" is what St. Cloud would like to think, and yet, in this telepathic underpass along the information superhighway, that simply wouldn't do, now would it? So instead he'd think cheerlessly, "Well, at least people don't call me Lickjaw." And outwardly, of course, good old St. Cloud would be biting the bullet by grinning and bearing it. What else could the poor chump do? "Rather, what? Ha ha," he'd offer sort of half-heartedly, and would then continue more ruefully than otherwise. "Right ho, pip pip. Jolly good, what? My first 25 summers, as they say, those were, what we used to call the best days of our lives and all that rot, eh, what? The good old so-called formative years, weren't they, what not? And to think, ha ha, that for me they all smelt like a bloody public urinal, didn't they, eh, what? I say, we could certainly be a dashed bloody lot of little buggers back then, I dare say, what?" And then after gauging his listener's response, "But what ho, eh? Pip pip, double plus good and all that rot, what? Jolly good show, of course, wouldn't you say, eh, what? All in fun, no doubt, and jolly good fun at that, or I'll be bound, eh, governor? And I say, isn't it a scream? I mean, isn't it just ripping? About what a jolly, blessed, little, jolly crew of high-spirited little rascals and scalawags we could find it within our fulsome little hearts to want to be back then, don't you think?" St. Cloud would be practically quacking like a duck, sounding a bit like a British Paul Harvey doing some kind of tenth-rate vaudeville routine. And of course, I'd feel sorry for the poor bugger, but what could I do? What could anyone do? And just then eternity would happen, and it would prove out to be a bit of a rum do, wouldn't you know? And there wouldn't be a damned thing any of us could do about that either. And so on and so forth, and with due consideration, world without end, don't you know? What? And so, on with the great experiment, if we can possibly manage to tear ourselves away from the unbridled merriment and whatnot, I dare say. And I sometimes like to think of Smiley as a sort of Jeeves figure to St. Cloud's food stamp edition of Bertie Wooster, as if their whole trip had been conceived by some poor man's P.G. Wodehouse. But then their larks and whimsical sallies would have had to have been a lot more fun, and all the tragedy, of course, left out. Besides, Smiley was off drinking or something with the dinosaur, and both had made it clear by now that they did not, alas, care to be involved in the present tricky scenario in any way, shape, fashion or form of any kind whatsoever. And that, of course, was that. Yet the great rubber experiment was fairly simple and required no assistance in particular. If only it would work. And the plan called only for simple ingredients which were easily available in the open marketplace, so far, to almost anybody. To wit, 1, a condom, and 2, a rubber band. And I guess you get the idea, right? The teenage St. Cloud would dutifully attach the receptacle to his teenage dick, cutting off his typical teenage blood supply there a little, I guess, and the rest was up to Lady Fortuna. And surprisingly, this fool scam actually worked about half the time. St. Cloud would wake up sporting an aching hard-on, festooned with a sporty little bag of piss all ready for disposal. Other times, though, he'd piss the condom off in his sleep, or feel it sliding off his dick as it filled with the detestable fluid. In any case, he had to stop for fear that prolonged cutting off of the blood supply to his dick might just happened to cause his dick to fall off or something. Experiments are like that. Who could really say for sure? Another experiment involved standing up all night instead of sleeping in bed, but this came to nothing as well. For what it's worth, St. Cloud also first started to masturbate, circa 9 or 10, with an eye toward the wide-eyed theory, since exploded, that this activity might make him stop bedwetting as a kind of trade-off or something, perhaps on the principle that a little wet can go a long way, I guess. Surprisingly, however, it seems that this failed experiment was held over indefinitely, long after the problem was over, in fact. In fact, it continued right up to the bitter end. Go figure, right? But that's it. Enough is enough, all right? The joke's over now, and we can shit-can the big spotlight on St. Cloud's creepy little tragedy. And it was a tragedy, if you think about it. Oh, sure, I mean, yeah, I laughed, too, at the keyboard when I first read about all this. But I no longer see what's so damned funny, and I don't quite know how in hell I ever did. The guy's life was wrecked by having sleep for an arch enemy. He never got over it, and never stopped hating sleep. His existence was a living undeserved hell, and a classic study in alienation. He was a permanent exile from humanity, and an outsider in his own miserable fucking life. And all this on top of a world-class psychosis that he was going to be stuck with anyway. Too much, huh? And just to have even more fun, it turned out that merely waking up each day to the tart and tangy fragrance of fresh urine wasn't nearly enough of a hassle. Oh no. So St. Cloud also got to have screaming nightmares on a pretty regular basis. Toward the end, he'd even taken, frighteningly, to a spot or two of somnambulism. And so he wound up hating to sleep. Wouldn't you? And so he started in on coffee and caffeine pills while he was in high school to put off sleeping. And wouldn't you? And so he graduated to black market diet pills, amphetamines, during his college days. And wouldn't you too? And so he even tried Ritalin once, at first liking it and then horribly crashing for the entire length of time that the lift itself had lasted. and he hated and feared crashing, and you would too. And so he registered for the compulsory deaf lottery at age 18 and frankly didn't give a sweet goddamn about it one way or another. And nor would you have either, I don't think. And so when it became time to get addicted to Treasonol, he just said, lead me to it. And just what the hell would you have said? And so when he was called upon to inhabit a brave new world for 1.5 years, a world in which he only had to sleep once or twice a week, he said the equivalent of glory hallelujah. And so what do you have to say for yourself anyway? And so when he was asked what he had to say for himself at that point, he just mumbled, oh yeah, right, snort. I always did say, or words to that effect, because he'd even taken to snorting the stuff and was, in any case, suffering at that point from some weird kind of amnemonic aphasia, my dear Watson, or something of the sort, anyhow. And how, might one ask, have you suffered lately? And so when Big Brother capriciously cut him off for good, he could only manage to yelp something like, for the love of God, Montresor, in some kind of strangled voice or something, and I can add that he meant every word of it, because he actually liked taking the stuff, and because he didn't give a damn about his health, and because he didn't want to have to kick, and because he dreaded the relentless sensory siege and nervous capitulation that was withdrawal, and because he hated sleep, and above all, because he was near mortally afraid of having to crash. And finally, because it seemed that one can't make a breakthrough without crashing a few parties unless you happen to have a bad case of Treasonol aphasia and whatever the hell else it was supposed to be, or something, I guess. And so, have you heard any good ones yourself lately? And so if it were you, as it were, who knows? But if it were me crashing forever there like that, I'm afraid I'd wind up hating the whole fucking world, as it were. I'm very much afraid I'd wind up having to hate you all. How about you? 21. Excuse me, did you just mumble something like, ate you already? Bella Madonna inquired with some concern, because inquiring minds want to know, I guess. Duh, I managed, dimly noting that her cute little silk jockstrap was still only down to her knees. She eyed me closely while I tried to eye the sweet revelation of her magnificent crotch. I noticed that her pubic hair was trimmed into a cute little hourglass shape, leaving her pretty little bald genitals exposed to the naked eye. I also savored the dusky little tuft of fur that I could see hanging from her voluptuous anus, left there as a sort of honor guard, I guess. I wanted to taste it, but I was also sort of wanting to throw up right about then from faint nausea brought about by my empty stomach, and also from a panicky sense of overwhelming disorientation. Hey, are you all right, man? You look like you're gonna be sick or something. I hope it's not because of me or anything.
No. It's only that I'm feeling a little, I tried to explain. She brightened, perhaps sensing my distress again.
Oh, so it's just a mild case of queasy tongue, then, is it? Don't worry, I have just the thing.
She darted away. I didn't think that I wanted to start puking again, to the extent that I could even comprehend the process involved. Instead, I just sat there, staring blankly off into space, with cold cum still dripping from my wilted prick, trying to make sense of everything, or even of anything. Presently, she returned, brandishing a flask of murky green liquor, which probably wouldn't have looked any too palatable had I been a little more alert and a little less under her spell.
Drink this, it'll set you right up, she urged.
Irk, I gagged. It tasted fucking awful, and though I was past caring about what was in it, I had to ask anyway. That stuff, what?
Sometimes it's called swamp water, and sometimes it's called bug juice, but we mostly call it ichor. It's a mixture of occult herbs and exotic spices. Did you like it?
Vaguely, I managed to wonder if occult herbs meant the plants known as Satan's symbols, or the ones called herbs of grace. I remembered, sort of dazedly, that both categories included various hallucinogens, but what the hell is what I more or less figured by then. Do I still get to eat you out after all that? I asked her, hopefully, wondering what she'd done with the G-string that she was now no longer wearing.
Her eyes twinkled mischievously as she replied, "Better let that settle a bit first. But don't you worry. It'll set you right up, and it won't spoil your appetite in the least. And then, yes, you can munch my clam to your heart's content, or whatever."
She blushed charmingly at that point, beneath her mask, true, but I could still see some of it. I smiled. Like my role model, Lovecraft, I hate seafood, but this dish really did look good enough to eat.
Spicy, huh?
Or maybe not your cup of chowder, what?
Well, okay, who cares?
I just thought I'd point out that it doesn't have to be like this, you know? Or maybe you don't know. They say that variety is the spice of life, and infinite variety is what I'm really talking about here, at the moment, anyway. For most people, one world is enough. One universe, one God. And that's okay, that's just fine for most people, just as long as they can tolerate other people's ideas and gods. Sadly, though, it often transpires among people and gods that, as they say in the Westerns,
this here one hoss town just ain't big enough for the both of us, varmint.
And then one or the other has to crawl away and split, or they both have to throw down and see who gets to walk away. But it doesn't have to be this way, really. It doesn't have to be like anything at all. It doesn't even have to be at all. It's entirely your call, really. Put the book down. or don't put it down. Either way, you wind up in one of two at least slightly different worlds, one in which you did or one in which you didn't. Not to mention the worlds where you didn't get a chance to decide because an airplane crashed into your house, or for that matter, because a meteor struck your house or even wiped out your planet. Guess the call isn't entirely yours at that. But this dichotomy, this branching of alternate futures, happens all the time, all day long and all night too. And it's happening to everyone there is. And each time it happens in an infinite variety of ways, because the you that didn't sort of implies the you that did, so to speak. Most of these cusps seem trivial, and many of them are, but you never can tell. For instance, where exactly were you, and what exactly were you doing today at the precise moment when you were not being run over and killed by a truck? You just never can tell. Besides, many of the largest cusps are composed of or heavily influenced by a whole random bunch of the smaller ones, perhaps a different bunch in each of a billion different continua. This model of existence is sometimes called, in science fiction or speculative fiction circles, the alternate history or what-if subgenre. And the stories all go pretty much like this. What if ancient Egypt had developed space travel? Or what if Carthage had destroyed Rome? Or what if the Armada had conquered England? Or what if Columbus had only opened up a hot dog stand instead? Or what if Booth had shot a Lincoln Continental instead? Or, well, you name it. By the way, I'm not attempting one of those books here, in case you wondered. Such books or stories are much too hard to write, and I could never pull it off. Hell, look how quickly I floundered just trying to make up those premises. No, I just hang out here because I like the decor and the freedom of the overall concept. It's like St. Cloud's ideal. Suppose everyone who ever did or could exist expressed everything that could be expressed in every way that it could be expressed, and what if they all did it at the same time and in the same place? That's the omniverse. That's sort of like what everything must look like to God, if there is a God. And if you want to know just how alien that God would be, try to picture this state of existential pandemonium for yourself and understand that God would probably objectively have to look something like that, because it's all, as they say, in God's image, and it's all supposed to be God's work. Nice work, if you can get it. Anyway, I could explain all this a lot better if I could show you, in a small way, how those tales get conceived, or what kinds of things they're based on, anyway. And it so happens that I have an excellent example right at hand. But first I have to explain about the John Barr Hinge. Can you say John Barr Hinge? I knew you could all along. The trouble with writing alternate history is that you have to know a lot about actual history to make it work. One of the all-time finest examples of making it work is the Hugo Award-winning The Man in the High Castle, a masterpiece of the subgenre by Philip K. Dick. In Dick's novel, Germany and Japan were one World War II, and did it quite convincingly, thanks to Dick's verisimilitude and richness of detail. It's a treat to see Hangman Heydrich still alive and kicking, but it's somehow an even bigger treat, for me anyway, to see guys like Kaltenbrunner, Heydrich's erstwhile replacement in some parts, still hanging thanklessly around in the remotest background of Dick's story after some 20 years. Still just running the post office, don't you know? Still just following orders with or without a signature. Now that's verisimilitude. And after all, it's those little touches that mean so much. But the big question is, of course, how did things get this way? Why did the Axis powers wind up winning the war? And that's where the John Barr hinge comes in. It's the secret ingredient. But this one will have to remain mostly secret unless you want to read Dick's great book, which I highly recommend. I'll only say that Dick selected an actual historical incident which predated the war and caused his changes to occur convincingly from the point where that incident deviated from what actually happened in our history, and thus that incident was the story's John Barr hinge. A John Barr hinge is just a plot device in this business. But the term is derived, I believe, from the story The Legion of Time, 1938, by Jack Williamson. Anyway, as in Dick's novel, the John Barr hinge is simply the point in our history, the cusp, at which some major event goes differently enough to diverge from our world's future from that point, and to create an alternate one based in these stories upon clever extrapolation, often including a lot of irony. Naturally, these cusps are all arguable and open to debate. Would this or that really have changed history that much, or in those particular ways? But in fact, who knows? And who cares? Properly done, such stories are intensely fascinating. And in any case, it's nice work if you can get it. But what we can know is this, that if all this happened once, all this being our universe, it could probably happen again, given enough time. And given infinite time, it could probably happen again infinitely, even just the way it is now. This is a variation of the oscillating universe theory, which more or less postulates a Big Bang followed by expansion to some maximum point of the universe thus created, followed by contraction as the weight of the matter in the universe causes it to fall back in upon itself, which either creates or at least sets the stage for another Big Bang. Interestingly, the myopic Hubble telescope, NASA's expensive idiot child, recently tried to explode this theory by claiming that all the matter in sight wasn't heavy enough to oscillate. An easy call, right? I mean, it's not like we can go out there and check it, right? But it soon turned out that we could sort of check using X-ray satellites. And the good old X-ray satellites managed to detect what seems to be invisible matter, and even managed to postulate that most of the matter in the universe is invisible. That's certainly one in the eye for the vainglorious Hubble scope. and thus the oscillating universe theory is dramatically reinstated as a viable theory. In all fairness, I should mention the main competitive theory, sometimes called the steady-state universe theory, which postulates no Big Bang, no end, just an ever-present universe that also somehow expands or something, I guess. But since I don't understand this theory, I'll leave it to its brown-nosed little psychophant, the Hubble telescope, to explain and promote, since it likes that precious little theory so damned much. I like the oscillating universe theory because it's easy to pretend to understand, easy to visualize, and also because it helps to explain what alternate histories we can even helps to explain about alternate histories. We can even postulate how long each universe phase would last. About 80 billion years, last time I checked. And it's obvious that if the universe keeps happening over and over forever, then we might even wind up with a universe someday where the Hubble telescope knows what it's talking about. And like I said, there's nothing to prevent this universe right here from happening again and again. Parallel universes, though, the ones that split off from some John Barr hinge, would be simultaneous to this one to some extent. They'd also exist laterally to this one and would be a lot harder to visualize, branching off constantly as they do. But they might be able to oscillate too, if they're heavy enough. And so maybe they could eventually repeat themselves too. But just try rolling a bunch of successive boxcars or something at dice and see how often they come up. That's about how often our world would happen again, only factoring in an infinite number of dice combinations. Hence, variations from infinitesimal to extreme would tend to be the general rule. This is more or less dictated by the laws of probability. And be sure that there are probably undercover I-Corps agents hanging around everywhere, just waiting for a chance to enforce those laws. So don't get your hopes up for an instant replay. Of course, the next alternate universe might be exactly the same as this one, except that you're wearing a bow tie right now, or not wearing one, as the case may be. But would that be the real you? Confused at all? I sure am. But maybe I can simplify things a little bit. Some things, anyway. I keep in my apartment, back home, a splendid little artifact from an alternate history. It's a Collier's Encyclopedia from 1959, a family heirloom of sorts, left over from my long-lost childhood, an era which may still exist somewhere, or which may yet exist again someday, but I hope not. Anyway, the 1959 Collier's insists that Cuba is governed by a man named Batista, and that some obscure bearded rebel named Castro only tried to take over, that's all. But he failed. Case closed. Go away and leave us alone. And that's that. Simple, huh? Oh well, Colliers never did know their asses from their elbows, I don't suppose. Nor did anybody in 1959, I don't suppose. And who the hell cares what they think anyway, right? But I love it. It's like the crown jewels or something. Good old Collier's. My little interdimensional treasure, a relic of a vanished continuum, frozen in time. What fun. As for Cuba's fate, well, so it goes, by all the myriad ways. But did you notice just how quickly and easily and unobtrusively that one got away? You just never know. And remember that Castro's lucky big cusp was made up of countless little ones, even trivial ones, some of which, had they but known, could probably have fucked things up royally, if so desired. I sometimes wonder if there really are any trivial cusps. Einstein didn't seem to think so. Didn't he say that all the atoms in existence are connected or something? Well, there you are. And guess who's creating our world, your world, old sport? Nice work, if you can get it. But even Collier's circa 1959 isn't all just fun and games, you know. In Orwell's novel, 1984, people like Winston Smith would have had to rewrite every existing copy, retroactively and as many times as necessary, right up to infinity. And my unrevised edition would be evidence of thought crime, would be, in fact, a thought crime itself, and would have to be taken into custody and made some kind of example of or something, if only in the torture chambers of the thought police. And I can just imagine it, helplessly coughing up its arcane secrets, wishing they'd shoot it instead, or even wishing it had never been written at all. But getting back to Cuba, it seems an awfully historic locale, in this neck of the Matrix anyway. No, not because of my dear little hapless encyclopedia, but because of the Cuban Missile Crisis, a perfect case in point of what I've been talking about, except for one little problem. The reason it's no good for a what-if story is the nature of the cusp itself, the most dramatic one we've ever faced, or that our big brothers have bothered to tell us about, at least. Because of Cuba, our whole operation almost became one of those moot continua we sometimes hear about, the empty places, the junkyard worlds. And that seems the only probable major alternative to what did happen, oft the case, I believe, with a cusp of that magnitude. And to be or not to be is very often all that it really boils down to, as I see it. But how many alternate histories can be written entertainingly about the self-same end of the world? An interesting question. Another interesting question, how many people actually read this stuff anyway, and how many of them could be said to actually give a rat's ass about it? Still, it's a pity that so pivotal a cusp would make such a lousy story, because there were plenty of John Barr Hinges around back in those days, and everyone had so much sheer pluck. Given our track record so far, and our luck, and our pluck, I'm kind of surprised that probability actually let us get away with it. But those useless silent realms attest that it doesn't have to be this way, you know? Want to make something of it? And so what, you might ask, were the potential John Barr Hinges in Cuba? A good question. And as it happens, I can write about this with authority, almost as a war correspondent, sort of, because you see, I was there. No, not there in Cuba. There in the continuum, sitting in the vast audience for the missile crisis follies, waiting to see what would happen next. And next thing you know, Big Brother clamped a lid on some of what happened next and left it there for years or something. But the truth finally slithered out somehow, and naturally it came slithering around to my place just in time for the gala 25th anniversary celebration of the missile crisis, sort of subtitled, Getting Away With It for a Quarter of a Century and Liking It. Once upon a time, on October 26th, 1987, a magazine called Newsweek published a story entitled Cuba, Even Dicier Than We Knew, by an American ambassador, one Raymond L. Gardhoff, who'd been a State Department advisor during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And the beans he spilled regarding events of October 22, 1962, let alone other ineptly handled affairs, really paint a damned nice picture of dumb fucking luck, if beans can be said to paint pictures. But they were rather dicey damned beans at that. And it all just begs the question, what? Really? 25 years? Are you quite sure? And me? Hey, I was just a kid, okay? I was just out farting around somewhere or something. Do you mind? I didn't have anything to do with anything. I didn't even know what was going on. Hell, I wasn't even anywhere around Cuba. You got that? How should I know what I was doing that day? I was only just 11 years old and psychotic in the bargain. To me, it was just another day. But once upon a time, it was rather a dicey day indeed for some people, and especially for President John Fitzgerald Kennedy, who had to go on TV and announce the crisis to the American people. I wasn't listening, but I can tell you for him that it was like the government, or even our entire species, having to announce some big accident in its pants to mommy, and with the prospect of a worse accident to come looming around, the worst accident of all time, just the kind of dicey business you don't want going on in your pants on a day like that, even if your mother was nowhere around. But JFK did okay, I guess. He could have shirked his sad PR duty by starting the war at once and suddenly being too busy for TV. But instead he came through like a trooper. And so we were spared that dicey but improbable resolution to things. And I really don't know if I saw his speech or not. It wasn't the kind of thing I normally watched at the time, but it was probably on the radio too, wasn't it? Let me see now. The trouble is that I didn't much care about the date back then. Only the day of the week, if that. And frankly, I only remember two things about the missile crisis in the first place. But one of them was on TV, and the other was on the radio, and together they snapped me out of my childish psychotic fog and woke me up to the events going on around.